Hello, and welcome to the Degree of Freedom podcast. My name is Jonathan Haber, and today we're going to be joined by Jeff Young, Senior Technology Editor for the Chronicle of Higher Education. Jeff's been covering the technology beat at the premier publication for colleges and universities since the Chronicle decided an earlier technology, the internet, might not be a fad after all and went ahead with creating an online version of their weekly periodical. And the decades he spent seeing new technologies and trends come and either go or stay shall provide some needed perspective on the MOOC phenomena. And perspective is exactly what we need right about now. For wasn't it just over a year ago that people were speculating that massive open online courses meant the imminent death of the traditional university, with predictions that only 24 campuses would survive the upcoming shakeout? But no sooner had that zeal cooled slightly than a new set of hysterical narratives emerged claiming that college administrators were sharpening their axes, readying to cut the jobs of every professor teaching a class that could be covered by the latest MOOC, coupled with a somewhat contradictory assertion that things such as high dropout rates demonstrated that MOOCs were worthless as educational tools. Now, perhaps before we decide that MOOCs are a gift from the gods or the work of Satan, perhaps some analysis supported by actual data might be useful. For instance, declaring MOOCs to be a failure because of high dropout rates needs to be based on something more than just putting the initial enrollments in the denominator of a fraction and sticking the number of certificate earners in the numerator. How many people who didn't receive a certificate had a successful auditing experience with a course, for example? How many learned how demanding a class was only after it started and realized they couldn't invest the time right now, but might restart the course if it's offered later? And how many people just signed up to get something for nothing? In addition to numbers, we could also use a dose of history, notably the perspective of someone who could fit the MOOC story into the context of how online education has been evolving over the last two decades. And I can think of no one better to provide this background than today's guest, who's been reporting on technology in higher ed since the dark days of dial-up. Jeff Young, welcome to Degree of Freedom.
Wow, thanks for having me.
Jeff, can you talk about your background and how you came to run the technology desk at the Chronicle of Higher Ed?
Yeah, sure. Well, I've been at the Chronicle a long time, and I got into it wanting to cover technology. And this was, if you can imagine, back in 1995, the Chronicle didn't yet have a website. Like many publications, were just starting to dabble in that. And so I got hired on as an intern, and they weren't sure if they were going to keep a website, if they weren't sure whether it was something that needed to keep happening. But they ended up solidifying it, and obviously over the last 17 years or so, we've expanded and expanded the web, and now every publication, of course, has gone through a lot of evolutions with publishing. So I kind of got in on the ground floor of the Chronicle's web publishing efforts. And it's been exciting, and I really kind of fell in love with covering the college world specifically. And so for a lot of the time I've been here, I have covered tech, but I've done some other beats too along the way here and there.
Okay, and when did the MOOC phenomena first show up on your radar?
Well, it depends on how you define it. The term MOOC took a while to kind of bubble up, but we actually have a timeline that we published on the Chronicle's website, which I totally recommend, which is what you need to know about MOOCs. And the first article we have on that is from 2008, which now it seems a long time ago, but they weren't using the term. It was most people were talking about open teaching, I think, was the way people were talking about it. Because, of course, there was open courseware. That dates back for more than a decade from MIT, you know, opening up individual course materials. But none of those early efforts promised replicating a classroom beyond just having some lecture videos or lecture notes. And so there was an experiment that we wrote about in 2008 from Utah State University by David Wiley, who was an education professor who decided to open up his course to any auditor from the outside who wanted to do it, and he would give them a certificate if they finished. And he only had a few takers. This was not massive. And so it was a couple years later that in about 2011, there was a experiment. So now we're talking about just 2 years ago, something that George Siemens did out of a Canadian university, who sort of decided, just like David Wiley, to say, let's open up the classrooms. He was teaching a course, and this is where it gets kind of meta. He was teaching a course about open learning. You know, it was about connectivism, which is a philosophy, a kind of learning theory. So he had this class on connectivism that he was co-teaching, and they opened it up to anyone who wanted to from the outside. And they actually got nearly 2,000 students. It was actually 2,300, I think, students. And that's when it was a couple people around that class that coined the term MOOC that actually started to say, hey, this is a massive open online course. So that was a long-winded way of saying you can date it back to 2008 or maybe just 2 years ago. The actual term is probably only just a couple years old.
And the Chronicle's been the go-to place for following the MOOC story, particularly these last 2 years. What's been the general trajectory that the story has had, and what insights do you think you've gained from having followed it from the beginning?
You know, it's been interesting. At first, one of the things that was interesting from the beginning is that where is this drive or momentum coming from? The experiments that I just mentioned to you are very traditional, right? That's where in the past, that's the kind of thing you'd expect, where professors, in this case, professors of teaching and learning, were inventing, experimenting, putting out these ideas. But then soon after that, where it really took off in the popular press, and probably the reason you and I are talking about it today, was that some professors at Stanford, mainly Sebastian Thrun and Andrew Ng and Daphne Koller, those three really all were working in the same department at Stanford. And they're all computer science, specifically artificial intelligence researchers. And so the trajectory that is unusual, I think, for a higher ed story, a higher ed tech story, is that in a very short time, all of a sudden, in the past, you might have expected something to be invented and kind of tweaked and slowly gathered maybe some more experiments, one school by school or one or two here and there. But these entrepreneurs, these professors who kind of were entrepreneurial at Stanford University, decided to take a leave from their jobs and start for-profit companies and got all this venture capital funding. So it took off in a different way. It sort of got this Silicon Valley exponential growth curve going. And so here it is, just a couple years after the very first experiments in what people called MOOCs, we have literally hundreds of colleges around the world trying MOOCs and it being really the talk of very much the mainstream press and of circles way beyond just a few professors in a department covering education.
And if I recall, your pages have also been the place where some of the major MOOC controversies have played out. I'm thinking of that letter written by the philosophy department of San Jose State to Harvard's Michael Sandel, which was published in its entirety in your paper. Can you talk about that controversy and what you perceive to be the most important issues related to online learning that really continue to need to be debated?
Sure. So this took off so fast. There was certainly early on, even some professors were voicing some skepticism. If you think about it, the MOOC at its core, there's one assumption in there that you can automate some parts of teaching that people hadn't really accepted that would be automated before, like mass grading and delivering. The idea that one professor could teach 100,000 students, that's a pretty out there idea. I think a couple years ago, you would have had people laughing at that idea. And so here it is, the basis of these companies gathering all this venture capital. And so these things took off so quickly that we weren't hearing like a widespread backlash. And maybe this, I don't know for sure why that was. Perhaps it was out there and we just didn't hear it. And it's always possible when you're a journalist sitting in Washington, D.C., trying to cover a national or international trend. But I think part of it was happening very quickly. And this is free education on one hand, right? It's a philanthropic mission to give away education. So in a way, like to be the person that comes out and says, we don't like giving away education might sound a bit sour at some point. So a lot of professors were not voicing their concerns very loudly. And then, like you said, there was a letter that came out this year and it was sent to us at the Chronicle of Higher Education. And so we published this as an op-ed, and we wrote a news story, of course, about these professors' concerns. The philosophy department, as you say, at San Jose State, where a lot of these experiments were happening, really just kind of put out a call and said, this could be bad, that we have some concerns about the direction. You know, of course, free education is praiseworthy, but when you have the implications of taking a state university and changing the way the staffing is done, potentially reducing the number of faculty, potentially, as they saw it, perhaps cheapening education, lessening the product. In their view, their concern was in the long term, you could be creating a less quality state institution just to save some money. And that was something that they were trying to raise a more public debate about. And I think you are seeing a little bit more of that debate now.
And how would you describe the status of the debate? I think we've left the point of hyperinflated enthusiasm, but I wouldn't necessarily say we've reached a point of widespread skepticism either.
It's a little tricky to know. Sometimes when I go out and talk to people, I hear some people say, oh, you guys are overly hyping MOOCs. And then other people tell me, oh, you guys are overly beating up on them. And that makes me feel good. I think, you know, we're trying to be somewhere in the middle. We can't please everybody. We're not taking sides. We publish, like I said, op-eds on one side, op-eds on the other side, and news stories that are balanced. As far as the level of the volume right now or where the debate is, I think a lot of people are very skeptical in higher education of for-profit and profit motive. You know, the tradition of the higher education system in this country that made it great has been around largely nonprofit efforts. And so I think that's one clash you're seeing. And you're also seeing real talk about what the future of higher education should look like, whether these technologies should be used to replace even any aspect of professor. And of course, people joke about the hype curve. You know, there's this Gartner hype curve, and for all kinds of technologies, you can usually see a kind of template play out where things get overhyped, and then the backlash comes, and people are overly skeptical, and then something in the middle happens. And so, you know, I don't know if it's so simple as to say that there's some sort of template that always happens. I'm not sure I totally buy that. But I do think you certainly do hear very loud voices on both sides. And the reality is that usually things over time do shake out a little bit. Although I think in this case, you really do have very big questions about whether automation should come to the higher education at all. And so it's not necessarily the exact same thing as saying an iPhone comes out, and so that's going to have a hype cycle. I think it's a little different in this case, because we're really talking about higher education, and we're talking about not just the telephone, it's a very complicated process of educating people. And I don't even think there's a really strong understanding about how it works, even in a traditional classroom. If you or I went to a university right now and sat in the back of one of the best classes and sat through a whole course and learned something, I'm not sure exactly that we even know which parts of that experience are absolutely essential and which parts could be turned into a technology improvement or equivalent.
And speaking of traditional classrooms, a number of people we've had on the show, such as the head of edX and Coursera, have naturally been big supporters of MOOCs. But I also found that these same people are the first to talk about that something special that happens inside the traditional residential learning environment. What do you think is behind this interesting balance everyone seems to be trying to strike? And how does it fit with some of the stories and controversies you've been covering?
Yeah, no, I've heard the same thing. The magic that can happen in the classroom, I think some of the MIT folks have told me, yeah, they're really stressing. Well, for one thing, of course, these institutions' main mission, if you're MIT or Harvard or Stanford or any of these universities that have taken the lead on MOOCs, their mission statement is about traditional learning. It's classroom learning, but really the core of it is something broader than simply kind of injecting information into people's heads. It's about citizenship. It's about, you know, you might understand fuzzy concepts, right, of teaching people how to learn or how to be critical, which are skills that you could date that back to hundreds or thousands of years of the way higher education has taken its role. And so I think certainly that magic might be another way of saying that we don't even know how to understand it. It is tricky because there's been a lot of talk about what the business model is for MOOCs. And you could almost flip it and say, how do MOOCs fit into the mission of a place like MIT or Harvard or Stanford, or name your college down the street, wherever you are? How does giving away a free education fit into the mission? Because some of these courses, at least at this stage, I think what they're saying is they're not equivalent of what you'd get if you go show up on the campus. And so I think that's really making the distinction of this is not equal to, it's different. And then the question is, how does whatever this is, which is still being defined, fit into what colleges want to do and their mission? Is their mission to also educate the world? And if so, how do you pay for that?
You've been on the other end of the microphone enough, so you know that there's always that chance to speculate. So having heard MOOCs described as everything from the first new thing in education since the blackboard to transitional technology to the death of college as we know it, you've been immersed in this story probably more than anybody so far. What's your take on where MOOCs might fit into the broader educational landscape in the years to come?
This one's very tough. I will hesitate to give some grand pronouncements, but you know, I think a couple storylines are playing out, and it's not clear which one will take off the most. There's one level in which you can imagine, and in fact, I'll tell you, I had a conversation the other day with the president of Wesleyan University, who made an interesting point about using MOOCs to give people a taste. And you know, there is a lot of talk about what really goes on in a liberal arts education. It is fuzzy, like I said. So one way to do it is to experience it. And so he's arguing that they're MOOCs, and he's even teaching one. And when you assign major works of literature and then have the students in these free courses discuss those pieces of literature and watch in on actual discussions at the classroom level, have their own discussions on websites, do some homework, write a paper, have it peer graded. Well, this is starting to kind of give the home game of what a college is. His comment kind of boiled down to it's marketing for colleges like his and for even the broader liberal arts endeavor to say it's outreach, but it's more than outreach because you're not just reaching out. You get this interactive thing going between the students and the institution. This is not going to sound as grandiose, but there might be a way in which typical colleges end up having a few MOOCs, just the way that now hundreds and hundreds of colleges have YouTube channels where they have some short videos of interviews with their lecturers or interviews with their researchers. Many, many colleges probably now have Twitter feeds or Facebook pages. And these are all forms of outreach. You know, you could argue, why do you need to have a very extensive Twitter or Facebook presence at a college? But many do. And I think MOOCs might be one other way that that is added. Give a sample of a part of your portfolio of, and then the other questions of the big pronouncements of, could this totally reinvent campus as we know it? Could this give a very low-cost path to credit and replace part of the college experience? I think that one's a little more of a long shot, but you know, who's to say that it's out of the realm? It's tricky to say what level of disruption, I guess, is the big buzzword out there, but I think you're seeing a lot of different things being experimented with. Because I will say that one change that's already happened in the last 2 or 3 years is that the conversation that I hear among college leaders has changed, that there is more of a willingness to entertain what you might call the crazy idea of radical change or drastic reform in higher education. And there's just at least a more willingness to have the conversation, whether it'll turn out to be a more, you know, stick with the traditional higher ed way, which is to evolve quite slowly. Maybe that'll turn out to be the case again here.
And speaking of the future, I gather that you've just received a Nieman Fellowship to study at Harvard over the coming year. Can you tell a little bit about that program and what you're hoping to do during this upcoming year in my backyard?
Sure. No, I'm very excited to moving to your neighborhood, sort of into Cambridge. Yeah, I'm going to be spending an academic year at Harvard, taking a sabbatical from the Chronicle. I will be coming back after that. But where this year is really perfect for your conversation here, because I'm going to be studying MOOCs and kind of the future of learning. The Nieman program is great. It's the Nieman Foundation for Journalism at Harvard. It has this program where every year they bring 24 journalists on various topics, and there are 12 from the U.S., 12 from other countries. And so the 24 of us are going to gather at Harvard. Everyone's going to be doing their own research projects separately, but also we're going to get together in sessions to talk about the future of journalism and have seminars and guest speakers. And my job really, I think if it is a job, is to learn and to expand my knowledge. I take some classes, and I'm going to be working with folks at the Nieman Foundation and actually also at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society to look at how changes in the future of the internet, the future of education, the future of journalism kind of are all happening. And there's some similarities and things that can be learned across those things, I think, too. So I'm going to be very much in a learning mode.
Okay, well, sounds exciting. I'm looking forward to seeing when you move to town, and I'd like to thank you for joining us on the Degree of Freedom podcast.
Sure, no, thanks for having me. It's an interesting topic. I'm sure we'll all maybe be surprised by what actually happens.
That was Jeff Young, Senior Technology Editor at the Chronicle of Higher Education. And carrying on with that subject of perspective, I'd like to offer a couple of even longer-term perspectives based on two experiences, one academic, one personal. On the academic side, my Degree of Freedom one-year BA project is based on learning the equivalent of a philosophy degree in 12 months. And as anyone who's ever studied philosophy knows, this is a discipline dedicated to looking at all phenomena, including existence itself, from a perspective not overcrowded with worldly concerns, such as which university partnered with which MOOC provider and who just received the latest round of funding. For instance, everyone involved with education waxes rhapsodic about the virtues of learning. But what do we mean when we use this word? One of the earliest philosophical paradoxes centered on the claim that learning was actually impossible, since it either involves inquiring over something you already know, which makes it unnecessary, or inquiring over something you don't know, and since you don't know what that something is, you won't know when you found it. This paradox shows up in Plato's dialogue, The Meno, and is one that the protagonist of the story, Socrates, takes very seriously. And while we moderns don't need to come up with answers to this riddle as sophisticated as the one Socrates used, since Meno's argument turns out to be fallacious, it's not entirely clear that we know so much about what learning is and how people do it that we could declare a particular teaching method, such as MOOCs, to be fair or foul. The other perspective I'd like to mention derives from being married to an historian of technology, part of a generation of historians who focused on the social and economic constructs in which new technologies were introduced, grew, or died. For instance, those of us who reach into our refrigerator several times a day might easily assume that once this new technology became available, that the public immediately gravitated towards it, given all the health and convenience benefits it conveyed. But electric refrigeration actually took years and years to catch on, competing with other technologies, such as iceboxes that are also the subject of innovation, for a market that wasn't completely convinced of the need to keep food cold, regardless of which technology one used to cool it. Before this device could become a natural part of the home, that home had to be placed on the electric grid, making refrigeration technology depend on another technology, electrification. The cost of electricity, which refrigerators use a lot of, had to come down, making acceptance of the technology dependent on economic factors, and people had to be taught about the health benefits of keeping food chilled. Teaching the public about these benefits was the work of home economists, the subject of my wife's recent book. And these home economists, working within industry, academia, and government, became one of the many mediators that bridged the gap between the inventors of new household devices and the homeowners and homemakers who were making purchasing decisions about these newfangled gadgets. Dragging ourselves back to MOOC land, I don't think I finished a single course without thinking, gee, it would be nice if the course had better features such as note-taking or better organized discussion boards, or gosh, wouldn't it be great if I could join a course with a small group of similar students so we could create our own discussion sections and spur each other on? Or, can't someone teach the professor to turn off autofocus on his video cam and mic himself so the audio levels don't roller coaster during lectures? But who's going to be playing a mediating role by creating products like note-taking or improved commenting systems? How could small community formation be facilitated before a MOOC class starts? Where can professors turn to make sure their video production doesn't resemble a home movie? In some cases, these holes will be plugged by the institutions creating their MOOC classes or by the companies providing these underlying technology platforms these online classes run on. But other gaps are being filled by a new cohort of entrepreneurs who are starting some of the companies I've been writing about at the degreeoffreedom.org blog over the last week. And other limitations will be bridged by independent communities working out issues and forums inside and outside a MOOC class. The point I'm struggling to get out is we should not evaluate what this particular new educational technology means just by looking narrowly at who is creating courses, who is distributing them, and who is taking them. For as I mentioned in the blog several times, even if MOOCs disappear tomorrow, they have already created a new social norm in which colleges and universities that might have once clasped their intellectual property to their chest are now competing to see who could share more widely and deeply. And this is a norm that will not likely go away, even if the technology context in which it is currently playing out ends up being taken for granted, like the refrigerator, flames out, or, most likely of all, transforms. Anyway, this is the point that my aforementioned wife usually tells me to wrap it up. So with these nuggets of perspective in the mix, I like to call it a show. But not before inviting you all to join us on the next Degree of Freedom podcast.